It's a Cincinnati edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Lucy May. Coming up a little later in the program, we'll hear about Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Pureval's State of the City address, and we'll hear a recorded interview with WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson about former state legislator Connie Pillich's announcement she'll run for the Democratic nomination for Hamilton County Prosecutor. First, an investigative report from newspapers across Ohio found problems in youth prisons. They're understaffed, plagued with violence. The investigation found gang activity and lockdowns that last for hours. They're putting kids and guards in danger. The report got Governor Mike DeWine's attention. Joining me to talk about the investigation and what's happened since it was published, reporter with the USA Today Network, Ohio Bureau, Laura Bischoff. Hi, Laura.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you so much for being here. This was a big story. I'd like to start out just asking why you decided to start looking around Ohio's prisons. Why did you think this was a topic that you needed to investigate?
Well, just over a year ago, we had published a package of stories about the staff shortages and some staff misconduct within the Ohio Department of Youth Services. And then coinciding with the publication of that, there was some very serious attacks on some of the guards at Indian River, a juvenile correctional facility up in Stark County, as well as a 12-hour standoff between some youth that got out and a whole bunch of first responders and prison guards. And that ended with a State Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections SWAT team armed with pepper spray and zip ties, swooping in to end that standoff. And so we kind of were thinking about how really the entire system needed a deeper look. Like we didn't really delve into with that package of stories what was going on at the local level. And so we just decided it was worth taking a deeper dive.
And you spent a long time, about 18 months, is that right?
Well, I mean, it was like 8 months of, intentional records requesting and interviewing and writing and pulling things together. But I did, I was already on the story the year before that, just in trying to figure out what was going on.
So you've been keeping up with it for a while. The headline of the story really stood out to me. It says chaos in Ohio's youth lockups. Chaos is a pretty strong word. Why chaos? What did you find as you started doing your investigating?
Boy, I'll tell you, the surveillance videos really back up the chaos. In general, across the state and the local system, there's chronic, persistent staff shortages. There's not enough security staff. That means kids are locked down for long periods. When they are out of their rooms, there's violent clashes that break out in seconds. Staff members are really kind of fearful for their safety. Kids are also not feeling safe. And there's just, it seems like violence is a feature, not a bug of the system. And there've been some very serious injuries for juveniles and for employees.
So obviously a very dangerous situation, as you said. Why do you think that is? Is there just not enough money being spent? Are people not doing their jobs? I mean, I know there's a lot of answers to that question. What is there one that you can start with that you think may be the most prevalent problem?
Well, probably the most prevalent problem is that it's a very, very difficult job. These kids incarcerated have come from very traumatic backgrounds. They're acting out in extremely violent ways. And it's a hard job. And, starting out as a youth guard in the state system, it only pays $22 an hour plus, good state benefits. But, you could probably make that, working a warehouse job and you're not going to have urine thrown on you or somebody punching you in the nose. So they're just really, really hard jobs. I think that the turnover is very high. A lot of people go through the training, they get on the job and they quickly realize it's just not for them. And so you have a lot of brand new staff. And I think there's a learning curve to the job. And as a result, You get people who are more vulnerable to manipulation by the gangs inside the prisons and inside the juvenile detention centers. And so, you know, it just is, there's a lot of problems that are kind of daisy chained together. And I think a lot of it starts with staff shortages, and the staff shortages are because it's a really hard job and it's a tough market in which to hire right now.
I want to talk more about that, but let's define first who goes to these prisons, juvenile prisons, the ones that you are investigating. Are these, I believe these are kids that would otherwise be in adult prisons. I mean, who is the, for lack of a better word, the clientele?
So it's mostly ages 12 through the 20, up until their 21st birthday. The number of adjudications, which is like the juvenile system word for found guilty or admitted guilt, the number of adjudications for felony charges has actually gone down from, I think, about 5,000 a year 10 years ago to about 3,000. So it's actually declining. And of those who are adjudicated on felony charges, a small percentage of them, maybe like 10%, are committed into the care of the Department of Youth Services. So these are kids who have, you know, been re found responsible for violent delinquent acts, which, if they were adults, would be considered felonies. And, you know, keep in mind that juvenile prison is not the same as adult prison. The focus is supposed to be on helping these troubled kids turn their lives around and hold them accountable. And the state actually takes on the role of parent. So the government is responsible for these kids, their education, their health care, and their well-being.
And what, how is that going? I mean, it seems that they're, are they getting any of this kind of care, any of this kind of rehabilitation that will allow them to improve their lives and get out and have a, for a better lack of quote unquote normal life?
Well, it's hard to say. There's a lot of confidentiality when it comes to juvenile detention and youth prisons. But one indicator is the recidivism rate. That's the kind of the return rate. Within 3 years of leaving the Department of Youth Services, 43% of those kids return to prison, either the youth system or the adult system. And those who don't go back to prison face a higher likelihood of dying an early death. The Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus did a study that compared kids who had been incarcerated and are on Medicaid against those who had never been incarcerated on Medicaid. And there was like a 600% higher likelihood for those who had been incarcerated of dying an early death. And you talk to any guards who've worked in the system for any amount of time, and they can rattle off names right off the top of their heads of kids who die on the streets not long after they leave prison.
Well, let's talk about one young man that you talked to significantly and really followed through his whole life, Demarion Allen. He's 15. Why don't you tell us what happened to Demarion?
So, yeah, he was a 15-year-old kid. He was in the juvenile system. He got into some sort of trouble. He was in like a diversion program for mental health treatment for a while. Something happened where he ended up going to the Franklin County Juvenile Detention Center, and he was awaiting transfer into the state youth prison system. And this was on May 7th, and he was supposed to be kept apart from other kids, in particular this one kid with whom he had been fighting. And staff failed to do that. The two kids squared off, and it was a really fast 10-second fight. Demarion got slammed to the ground. He went limp immediately. Guards responded, you know, pretty quickly, and pulled the other kid off of him. But then the staff like immediately started to try to get him to sit up and roll him over. And then a supervisor came in and started yelling, "Get him into a cell, get him into, we can use force." And so they dragged him down a short set of stairs. They dropped him on his face, and then they plopped him awkwardly on a bunk inside this cell. And the whole time, Demarion is saying, "My neck, my neck, my neck hurts. Please put me on my back." And they're saying, "We're not going to put you on your back." So then a nurse comes in to examine him, and is poking his legs and moving him around, and at one point this 15-year-old kid, he realizes what's going on. He says really quietly, he says, "What if I'm paralyzed?" And he's paralyzed from the chest down. And we were able to go to Ohio State physical therapy appointments with him and visit with him and his family. He's the oldest of five kids. His mom is a single mom. And they're really struggling. And life is forever going to be changed for Demarion and his family members. He relies on his little brothers and sister and his mom for everything from feeding him to inserting his catheter and taking a shower.
All because of a 10-second fight.
Right. And his family is suing Franklin County Juvenile Detention employees for the way he was handled afterwards.
Now, did you see a video of this? How do you know it happened?
Yeah, these centers have lots of video cameras all over the place, and when there is an incident, at least in Franklin County Juvenile Detention Center, somebody comes in with a handheld camera to document what's going on. We had to fight to get those records. Franklin County was not forthcoming. We had to get our attorney involved in getting getting the county to fork over the records.
So you saw this, and as you're doing this investigation and you're spending time with Demarion, he is actually still in custody, even though he's at his home. Is that correct?
Yeah, the court has required him to continue to wear an ankle monitor to track his movements. Of course, he's not going very far. He's in a wheelchair, and it's kind of sort of ironic that they want to continue to keep track of where he is.
What's his outlook like?
He's got a great attitude. He calls physical therapy his one of his happy places. He says he misses the, having use of his legs, but he really hopes that someday he can, finish school and get a job and have a family. He's very interested in returning to sports. He's interested in wheelchair rugby. That's one of his goals, is to work up the strength to be able to participate in that kind of sport.
So what role then do these juvenile detention centers have in terms of trying to keep these kids safe? If they don't have the staffing to do that and they're supposed to be helping them, is there anything in place to try to keep them safe?
Well, I mean, they do have some staff there, and they are, I think the staff who are there for the most part are doing their best, but there's some pretty terrible mistakes being made. There's a we found a young woman named Alana Richardson. She was 17 years old. She had a 5-month-old baby. She and her boyfriend got into this fight and a scuffle with the cops in Urbana. She got arrested and was sent to the Central Ohio Youth Center in Marysville. Now, Alana had a known serious heart condition, and she died of that heart condition 2 days after her arrest inside this youth detention center. The coroner said that she died sometime between 7 a.m. and 10 a.m. on a Saturday in January, but the guards didn't notice that she had died until 3:25 p.m. It's like at least 5.5 hours. And in the interim, the guards marked off that they had done 26 wellness checks on her. And an internal investigation found that there was no neglect. And her mother is, she's grieving, and she wants answers. Like, how is it that you can't notice that her child was gone for at least 5.5 hours? And that is, I don't know if it's a staffing issue, a training issue, or what, but it's just very egregious.
So as you mentioned, the staff, there are certainly staff shortages, not only for guards, for teachers and nurses and counselors. What role do those folks play, and what are they supposed to be doing with the juveniles that are in these facilities?
Well, again, the government assumes the role of parent with kids in youth prisons, and so they have to provide education and health care and mental health treatment, and just provide for their overall well-being. And part of that is that they're legally entitled to education and health care. But it's interesting, about 1 in 4 teacher jobs across the Department of Youth Services are open, they're vacant, and almost half of the kids in DYS that are still in school have IEPs, individualized education plans, or 504 plans. And so they require intensive, individually tailored education. And it's just hard to see that how you would be serving these high needs kids when you have such a high vacancy rate. Similarly, 3 in 4 kids in state youth prisons are on the mental health caseload. They require mental health treatment. But half of the behavioral health jobs are open. Again, it's hard to conceive how they're giving the kids the education and the healthcare and the mental health treatment that they really need in order to position themselves for any chance of success when you have such high open job slots.
Have you talked to any of those employees?
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to a bunch of employees across the system. In general, they don't want to be named because DYS has required employees to re-sign a pledge that they won't talk about youth, that they're not authorized and that they could be disciplined, including terminated. But yeah, I talked to more than 100 people for this story.
Goodness. Well, let's talk a little bit about the reaction to the story. There has been, it came out, I believe, officially on Saturday or Sunday, something like that. And I encourage people, if you'd like to read it, you can find it at Cincinnati.com, probably Columbus.com too. Is that where your paper is?
Yeah, you can find it all across the our websites throughout the 21 Gannett-owned newspapers in Ohio. So that'd be Cincinnati.com, Dispatch.com, BeaconJournal.com. All the stories are free. We publish everything in a special 12-page printed section on Sunday, and then also posted everything online. And that gave everybody an opportunity to take a look at the project.
And our producer reminds me that we have that link on our website as well at WVXU.org if you want to find it there. Let's talk about the reaction, though. Governor DeWine did react. Tell us what happened after the reporting came out and the governor saw it.
So on Monday, the governor announced that he was going to put together a working group, a kind of a task force headed by Tom Stickrath, who had been the director of the Department of Youth Services, I think during the Taft and Strickland administrations. He also served as head of public safety, ran the Bureau of Criminal Investigation. So Stickrath's got a lot of experience. He's retired now. He's pretty close to the current director of Department of Youth Services, Amy Ast. I think they worked together, 20 years ago, and Tom Stickrath endorsed her for the directorship. So Stickrath and some retired juvenile judges, one sitting judge, I think a juvenile prosecutor, an academic, have all been agreed to serve on this panel that's going to dig into the issues that we outlined in the state system and also the local system. The state system, the responsibility ultimately falls to the governor. It's his appointee who runs the system. And the local juvenile detention centers are largely run by the elected juvenile court judges.
So he's decided to create this commission, and there's been reaction to that, and some people are not pleased. Tell us what that reaction's been.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to some parents and union leaders and families, and they just think that it's just not broad enough. I talked to one mom who has had a kid incarcerated since age 16. And she said, the moms and dads who've lived this nightmare should be included in this working group. There's also the Democratic leaders in the House and the Senate said that there needs to be an independent investigation. Also, the U.S. Department of Justice said that it's going to take a look at the project and any other evidence that it deems relevant and determine what the next, what should be appropriate. Back in 2004, the Ohio Department of Youth, the state got sued over conditions of confinement in the youth prisons, and the Department of Justice joined that lawsuit, and it got settled when Ohio agreed to increase staffing for mental health and healthcare and education and eliminate or severely reduce the use of solitary confinement. And so it's interesting because back in February 2022, a national group called the Galt Center sent a letter to the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division and said, "Hey, there's a lot of problems in Ohio's system. Would you come back, Department of Justice, come back and take a look?" And they kind of got ghosted, like nothing happened. We started to ask what happened with that inquiry. Then Department of Justice did meet with the Galt Center this past summer. And so it'll be interesting to see if there's any federal oversight that comes in as a
Well,
result of this.
and we're almost out of time, but we can certainly trust you will continue to follow up on this story.
Absolutely. We're not dropping it. We're gonna keep tabs on this in the coming months for sure.
Well, Laura, thank you so much. It's quite an investigation. I appreciate you taking the time today to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I've been talking with reporter with the USA Today Network, Ohio Bureau, Laura Bischoff. And if you'd like to find her reporting, there's a link on our website, wvxu.org. In just a moment, we'll hear about the Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Pureval's State of the City address. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Lucy May. Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Pureval gave his second State of the City address this week, and WVXU's Becca Costello covered the event. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Marianne.
So the mayor talked about a number of issues, including the deficit Cincinnati's facing. Let's hear what he had to say.
Right now, we are staring down a $30 million deficit in our general fund, a $400 million deficit in deferred capital maintenance on the capital side. The federal support that has helped us stay afloat is going to run out soon, and costs are rising faster than revenues.
So, Becca, how serious is the deficit? Is there money to manage it?
It is serious, and there's currently not enough money to manage it. So we mentioned federal stimulus. That's the American Rescue Plan Act, which the city got a lot of money for that. But as he said, it's running out. So the last of that money is expected to fill the deficit for this coming fiscal year. That'll be the budget they pass in June. But after that, no additional money is coming in. Now, is there enough money to manage it? As things currently stand now, the answer is no. So folks might remember there are two basically parts of the budget. There's the operating budget and the capital budget. The capital budget we'll talk about a little later with the railroad sale. The operating budget is really where things are still difficult right now. So basically the city relies primarily on the earnings tax, on income tax to run the operating budget. And the earnings tax is kind of in danger a little bit. Folks are working from home more. So that means if they live outside the city and used to work inside the city and the city could collect those taxes. If they're working from home outside the city can't collect that anymore. So that's kind of the big question mark at this point. So the money's not there currently, although there are some early signs of plans in place to turn that around.
Is there concern that without the money being there, that they're going to have to just start cutting?
Yes, I mean there are choices, right? So when you have a budget and there's not enough money to do the things that you're currently doing, you either have to find more money or you have to stop doing some of the things you're currently doing. So it's too early, I think, at this point to say which option they'll have to go with, because obviously the preference is to bring in more revenue and not have to make any cuts. But if nothing changes, cuts in the future are extremely likely.
So last year, the mayor announced the Futures Commission. It's a group of people working together to help the city deal with its financial situation. What's that group saying? What are they doing?
So we don't know what they're saying yet. So the mayor, when I talked to him about this, the day of the State of the City address, he made a point to say that he wants this to be an independent commission. So the city is providing whatever information about the finances of the city that is needed, but they're not involved in the meetings that have been happening all year. It's being chaired by P&G CEO John Moeller managed kind of logistically by the chamber, the USA Cincinnati USA Regional Chamber. There's about 20 or so members, and they're kind of split up into a few committees, but it's not officially a public process. It's something that, you know, the mayor says he's looking to the experts and he wants them to independently figure out what they think is best for the city. And of course, they don't have any decision making power. They'll come out with a report with recommendations on what they think the city should do. And then the city, primarily city council, will make those decisions. That report is expected in early 2024. I asked the mayor if he had any sneak peeks on what that's going to happen. He said, I'll be as surprised as you are. But I think there are some things that we expect to be included in there, whether or not it's a recommendation. Could be a recommended increase to the earnings tax or property taxes. It could be suggestions for strategic cuts in certain relations or certain departments to make things more efficient, that kind of thing. So there's a lot we can predict will be in the report. But as far as what they say the city should do, it is still very unknown at this point.
So that's not the only thing the mayor talked about. It wasn't just about money, right?
Of course.
He also talked about public safety. That's part of his agenda, improving public safety. And he had this to say about gun violence.
But I also want to paraphrase something City Manager Long told me. Justice and healing, it isn't enough. It isn't enough in the face of 22 rounds shot in 1.5 seconds. Into a crowd of children. We cannot accept anything less than an all-in approach if we're going to put an end to this senseless violence. We as a city are fighting like hell against the universal accessibility of guns, which, make no mistake, is contributing to the violence.
He's, of course, talking about an 11-year-old that was shot on a street corner a week and a half or so ago.
In the West End.
Yeah. In the West End, right. Tell us what he said about gun violence and why it's his priority.
Yeah, and to be clear, you know, gun violence has been a priority, I think, for every administration recently. You know, it has never gone away completely. Looking at the data, shootings in particular are trending down compared to the last couple of years. But as folks might remember, there was a huge spike in violent crime, particularly shootings, the first year of the pandemic in 2020. And so while the numbers are improving, Cincinnati and as most cities across the country have not reached those pre-pandemic levels. So that's kind of one of the targets in the near term. The other thing that we've talked about a lot on this program and the mayor has talked about a lot as well is although shootings are trending down, gun violence involving juveniles is up, and it's a kind of significant increase. As you mentioned, that shooting in the West End where, you know, five children were shot at, including as well as an adult. So, you know, it's the kind of thing that it never really stops being a priority. But that recent increase in juveniles involved in gun violence as both suspects and victims has been a huge concern. And so that's definitely one of the priorities. He said, you know, this is public safety is his first, second and third priority right now.
So those being his priorities, did he give any indication as to what he'd like to do to improve the situation?
Yeah, this is in conversation with him before the address and really digging into this issue. You know, he said that it's a bit of a difficult way to talk about this issue, right? Because the numbers are going in the right direction, but any kind of change and improvement takes so much time. And so, you know, he points to things that the particularly new programs through the city manager's office involving youth, that those have shown early signs of success. And so part of it is kind of staying the course and saying things are improving and we want to keep doing the things that look like they're improving. So he's not suggesting anything radically different than sort of the status quo, which can be frustrating, I think, for residents who, you know, witness this and experience this in their neighborhoods. But his point being, you know, if things look like they're working, we don't want to change course and risk going in the wrong direction.
So it's just a matter of seeing what opportunities they have next.
It is. And I'll be clear, you know, he didn't announce any new initiatives in this address. But, you know, looking at this is more on the city manager side of things, you know, I do know that they are constantly looking at what other cities are doing, what new programs might come up. So that's not to say that they're not willing to be flexible and make changes and try new things and put more, especially financial resources towards what they see as working. Just that at this point in time, nothing new was announced in terms of addressing public safety.
What about affordable housing?
Affordable housing is one that was featured less, interestingly, in this address than it did in the past and even in the year before that with the former Mayor Cranley. But the some significant thing that's been interesting is the carryover budget, the piece that has recently passed at City Council, put another $5 million in the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, or what's now known as the Leverage Fund. That's the second year in a row that the city has put that maximum amount into affordable housing that is now part of the process, the regular process for the carryover budget. And that's in addition to the millions that the city has put in. The mayor talked about that leverage fund. It's got over $100 million now, and that's sources from the county, some other local partners, private partners as well. And of what's been distributed, there is certainly much more subsidized units as the affordable housing units. So we're looking at like the 60% of area median income and lower at far greater levels than in recent years. I think really the issue is less about the amount of money that's available for affordable housing and more about the number of developers who are able to take those loans and grants and actually build housing with them. As I said, there's over $100 million in that leverage fund now, and they can't get it out the door fast enough because there just aren't enough developers willing to take the extreme financial risk of building affordable housing.
Wow. Well, all of that sounds worrisome, but there were some things that the mayor said that were more positive. Tell us about those.
Yeah, he really stressed the importance of this Brent Spence Bridge corridor project. So this is the companion bridge next to the Brent Spence Bridge, and celebrated the fact that President Biden was here at the beginning of the year to announce the about $1.6 billion in funding for that project. That's obviously something that's been kind of looked for a very long time. So to have the financial package pretty much in place at this point is significant. He also talked about the sale of the railroad. He mentioned the $400 million backlog and deferred maintenance on the capital side. So that's the other part of the budget that we haven't talked about yet. And this is one of the strategies that the city had been hoping to use to address that huge backlog, a way to bring in more revenue and address that backlog. And so the voters did narrowly approve that sale. So that is still in the works. There's a lot that still needs to be figured out in terms of timing. But it is significant for the city to be able to look ahead and say, we can expect a lot more money coming in compared to previous years. And that puts the capital side of the budget on much surer footing.
So speaking of the railway, there was a meeting yesterday, earlier this week, mm-hmm. About the railway. And you were in attendance, as you are at so many of these meetings, which we appreciate. You are our eyes and ears when we all can't be there ourselves. What did you find out? What are the next steps now that voters have approved the sale of the railway? It's not just a matter of, hey, give us a check and we'll see you later. What happens?
There's a lot that still needs to be figured out. So the meeting you mentioned is of the Board of Trustees that has, from the beginning, managed the Cincinnati Southern Railway. So it's the CSR Board of Trustees. It's a 5-member board that until now has really just kind of managed the partnership between the city and Norfolk Southern, who is the parent company that leases the line, and negotiates the lease payments. So they also negotiated the sale deal and pitched this as the idea to city officials and said, hey, we think this is a good idea to get a better return. That board is now transitioning to eventually it will instead manage the $1.6 billion infrastructure fund that will be invested, kind of like your retirement fund. And they'll decide when those returns come in, how much money the city should get each year and help decide how that money is invested.
So we should point out that the city is not spending the principal, just the interest on that money, correct?
Correct. Okay. With a few little caveats, but go online to read that because it's a little complicated. But yes, the intention is to never spend the principal. So one of the things that the board has to do now is hire a third-party private investment manager, an investment advisor. So these are companies that do this professionally. The city, the board put out an RFP asking for groups to bid on that contract opportunity. At the meeting this week, it was discussed, you know, how many applications have come in so far, 16, but they expect two others to come in. So they're looking at 18 applications from companies who want to be this investment manager. Now, the board is actually working with a third-party consultant, Davenport Group, to help them analyze the applications and make some kind of initial recommendations for, here are the groups that meet the qualifications you're looking for, here are the ones that don't quite meet those qualifications. And so the board is planning to meet a few times in January to review that information interview some of the top candidates, and they hope to make a final decision on that investment manager by the end of January.
When does the first check roll in? When does the money start coming?
So the primary, the main piece that everybody's excited about is the $1.6 billion kind of base sale price. Closing is expected on March 15th, 2024. So the expectation is that Norfolk Southern will send $1.6 billion to the city on March 15th.
Literally, just a check for that amount?
A check, probably a wire transfer.
Well, a wire transfer. But yes. But yeah, it's all coming at once.
One lump sum payment. Mm-hmm. Actually, a little bit more than that for a few reasons, but that's the primary piece. That will be sent to the city. And the expectation is that that investment manager, who should be on board by that point, will have a plan and will start investing that money on March 15th or maybe the 16th. Maybe they'll give him 24 hours, but that it'll be invested immediately. So that'll really sit in the fund for at least for a year before those investment returns are kind of given to the board to decide how much to send to the city. Now, that doesn't mean the city won't get any money until 2025. There are a few other things. You know, the city will still own the railroad until March 15th, and so they'll get partial lease payments for the beginning of the year.
March 15th, 2024.
2024. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So they'll get the city will get a partial lease payment from that. The Norfolk Southern also agreed to pay, like an extended transaction fee, basically. So that's like between $5 and $7 million a month in December, January, and February and March. Sorry. what are the months? it's a couple of different pieces. There's also some tax credits coming in. So there is some money coming in before that. But the principal amount that will really make a big difference in terms of infrastructure and spending in the budget will be calendar year 2025. And that'll be part of the fiscal year 2026 budget. So that's June 2025 to July 2026.
All right. And then does anything else have to be done, or does that group just continues, this investor group that is hired to manage the money will just keep managing that money until they're fired or on their own or something like that, right?
So that first contract for the investment manager, it'll initially be for a term of 3 years. And this is all according to the RFP that was put out, initially 3 years, and then the board will have the option to extend it for another 7 years. So that'll be a total of 10. And then at that point, there would be a reevaluation. So if after 3 years, the board is not happy with the performance, they could, of course, decide to go in another direction. So that's kind of the big piece there. The other piece is less on the board and more on the city, and that's kind of the city following through on some promises that this money will be spent equitably. This is a lot of the concern in the opposition to this sale, and as we mentioned, it was extremely close, less than 3,000 votes difference. More than 40,000 Cincinnatians did not want to sell the railway. And so, you know, that's a significant number of people that are looking for transparency, that are looking for the city following through on promises about equity in particular. So, you know, there's this plan that the city manager put together saying, here's how we could spend, here's how the city could spend the extra revenue over a 10-year period. It's a draft. You know, it's a framework. It's an outline. I do expect to see most of those specific projects will end up getting funded. But again, that's a proposal from the city manager. City council decides how city money is spent. And so it's up to city council. They won't decide that all at once. They won't vote on 10 years of spending in one single vote. It will come up as part of the regular annual budget process. So there will be specific projects that will be identified in the next capital budget. But this is not something where city council is going to vote on, you know, $100 million in funding all at one time. It'll be on a yearly basis. And I think for some folks that it can be concerning because obviously this plan was the promise for what the city was going to spend. But at the same time, I think doing it on a yearly basis as it normally is done, it gives time for flexibility for things to change and for folks to give more feedback on what they want to see the money spent on.
So to close the loop, since this money is not going to be really spendable till 2025, that does not help the deficit that the mayor was talking about for next year. And granted, this is just for infrastructure, but it won't
right.
make the capital budget look any better for at least another year.
Correct.
All right. Anything else I forgot?
Oh, probably more I forgot than you did, but go online. We've got lots of information there.
Well, that is absolutely true. WVXU.org. Becca wrote a very comprehensive story. And you can read the mayor's State of the City address online. You have that
yeah,
up
Yeah, or
as
watch
well.
The video as well. Yeah.
Thank you, Becca.
Thank you.
Becca Costello is WVXU's local government reporter. Cincinnati Edition will continue in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik filling in for Lucy May. This week, Democrat Connie Pillage announced she'll be running for the Democratic nomination for Hamilton County prosecutor next year. If she wins the primary, she'll face incumbent appointed Republican Melissa Powers.
We have to get the fraudsters out of boardrooms. We have to fight against these drug dealers who are destroying families and lives. These are the critical problems facing the prosecutor's office. The days of obsessing over party politics and political dollars will be over.
Pillage went on to talk about what she wants to happen if she's elected.
On my watch, prosecutors will reject racism, will reject sexism and bigotry of any kind. We will seek justice for victims of crime and for the criminals who perpetrate them, without bias. Justice is for everyone, not a select few.
Joining me to talk about the announcement is WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. Hi, Howard.
Hello, Marianne.
So this is a big deal. As you said in your column, you think this is going to be the race to watch. Why is that? Why is this so important?
I think because with Melissa Powers, who was appointed to the prosecutor's office back in January, this is kind of the Republican Party's last bastion of a county office where they have complete control, and they want to keep it. And they're going to pull out all the stops in order to get Melissa Powers elected, just because, you know, this is one of those things where it's top priority to Russell Mock, the Hamilton County Republican Party chairman. He made it very clear to me that there is no race on the ballot next year that's going to be more important to Hamilton County Republicans than to pull this off.
Well, let's talk about Melissa Powers just for a moment before we talk about Connie Pillage. She's been in office for just a short time. Can you explain how she got there after Joe Dieters left for the U.S. Supreme Court to take a position he was appointed to there? She got this job. How did that all come about?
Well, Melissa Powers, prior to this, was a juvenile court judge. And last year, she decided not to run for re-election to that seat. Now, prior to being on the bench, she was a longtime assistant prosecutor to Joe Dieters. But she was clearly, when Joe Dieters left to become Ohio Supreme Court Justice, he clearly wanted Melissa Powers to take over that office. And the Republican Party said, yeah, that's fine. I mean, we'll certainly go along with that.
So she's been in office for this short time, and Connie Pillage, as we just heard in the soundbite we played from her news conference this week, has been pretty critical of that office. What are her concerns, and what you talked to Connie, what do you think, why did she want to run?
Well, Connie is, you know, an experienced political person. I mean, she, you know, did her stint in the Ohio General Assembly in the 28th Ohio House District, which is kind of north central Hamilton County. It's represented by Jessica Miranda now. But, you know, she talked about the kind of the patronage, the system that's always worked. I mean, you know, this predates Powers by decades, and that she wanted to end it and make it a more professional office. She wanted more training at the outset for people who are appointed to assistant prosecutor positions. And she comes from a background, she's also been a public defender, so she comes from a background where she understands victims' rights, and she understands the rights of the accused.
You talk about her having been a representative in the Ohio House. She's also run for office and has lost a time or two. Can you talk about that and why you think she'd want to try again?
Well, in 2014, she ran for state treasurer in Ohio and lost. And all of the, I mean, it was just not a good time for a Democrat to be running statewide in Ohio. I don't think anybody's really held that against her, but she is, you know, she kind of got out of elective politics for quite a while after she was term limited out of the 28th district, and has concentrated on, she spent a year in working for an organization in Washington, which is a association of women judges. So she's had that kind of experience. She's very well known, and she understands too that she is running in a county that is becoming more and more Democratic every day. So, you know, I think they start out in, you know, she starts out in a pretty good position.
Do you think any other Democrats will run for the nomination?
No, absolutely not. John Cranley had thought about it, and then he said he wasn't going to do it. And the Democratic Party leadership started looking around and talking to other people, and they landed on Connie Pillage, who agreed to be the candidate. She's not going to have any opposition, you know, unless somebody who's completely unknown decides to file. But she'll be the endorsed candidate for the Hamilton County Democratic Party.
In the column that you wrote at WVXU.org, if anybody wants to read that, she talked about a criminal experience she had personally. Can you share that story?
Yeah, she was telling me about it. It was before her kids were born, and she was leaving her church one night by herself, and she got mugged. Somebody grabbed her and pushed her around and took her purse and ran off. You know, it was a kind of a traumatic experience. And they never caught the person that did it. But she says that was something that gave her a real sensitivity to people who are the victims of crime, and that she wants to do more as prosecutor to help them and support them.
Very quickly, as we wrap up, you talked about how this is the last seat right now in the county being held by Republicans in a county that is becoming more and more Democratic. If the Republicans lose this, what does that mean for Hamilton County?
Well, it's not quite the last seat, but it's the most significant seat that's held by Republicans because it has the most employees and it has the most money involved in it. If they lose this, I think the Hamilton County Republican Party understands that they are going to be in serious, serious trouble going into the future, even in the suburbs of Hamilton County.
Howard, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I've been talking with WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. Producer of Cincinnati Edition is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Lucy May.